A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rabona Podcast. I'm Musa Kwanga again and greeted by Ryan Hun and Michael De Silva to discuss this week's action. There's been plenty of glory if you're a Barcelona fan, but also sadly a bit more tragedy elsewhere in the football world. We'll get to that in a moment. But let's start with the Clásico and Barcelona's resounding 5-1 win over Real Madrid. Michael.
Well, Suarez is back.
Did he ever go away?
He never goes away.
Yeah. No, it was impressive by Barca. I mean, on current form, you have to say that they were expected to win, but they still have to go out and do it. And Real Madrid were completely out of sorts. And by the time this podcast goes out, maybe Lopetegui would have gone. Talks of Conte coming in. But yeah, it's been a difficult time for him, to say the least.
Interesting game, though, because the scoreline, you know, Barcelona won 5-1, but at one point it looked as if it could have ended up, you know, score draw, maybe 2-2, Modric had a chance at the post. And the flow of the game was quite interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the first half, well, the first 10, 15 minutes, Barca exploded and just, you know, went 1-0 up really early and could have really put Real Madrid out of sight at half time, I thought.
Right.
And then, as you said, the second half, Real Madrid made a change. Varane came off injured and they went to three at the back and kind of just seemed to abandon having any kind of midfield for the first 10 or 15 minutes of the second half. But actually, that was when they looked their most dangerous and really should have got level.
Well, I thought Varane didn't have a very good game at all, to be honest.
No, he really was quite poor.
Yeah, he was.
To be honest, he's not been great this season as a whole. He's had moments, but he's not having his best season.
Two bad mistakes back to back.
Yeah, and diving in for that penalty was uncharacteristic.
Mm.
But I would also say about Varane, it's funny because Cruz hasn't been his best either. And it's funny, looking at Real Madrid now, you're really seeing the core of that Champions League winning squad who are still pulling out the performances. So Modric actually was really quite good the other day. I thought Marcelo's quite funny because he's been their main goal threat. And the funniest thing, the situation that Madrid are in now that really captured it, was that Marcelo, I think he scored with his right foot. And in the first half, his best effort was with his right foot. So you've basically got a left back with his wrong foot being Real Madrid's greatest attacking threat.
Well, I mean, it was always going to be so tough to replace Ronaldo, but to lose Zidane at the same time as well. These are just two massive figures of this football club, which we shouldn't underestimate. We can't just say, oh, well, Bale can step up now and that's it. Bale was just, his body language was telling. Like when he wasn't getting the ball, he was like flinging his arms around and just had his head bowed. I thought it was a bit concerning.
I think it was very shrewd from Zidane to move on when he did.
Oh, without a doubt.
You know, I think he was well aware of how this squad wasn't progressing at the level that it needed to continually challenge in the league. Because that's where their focus has had to shift to, because they've not been genuinely contending for the league, you know, despite winning the Champions Leagues. And I think he knew that there was made, like I think we said last week, or Michael said, that there was major surgery needed on the squad. And I think he picked you're seeing that now, and he picked the perfect time to move on. So, I mean, I feel a little bit sorry for Lopetegui in one sense. I'm kind of split on it. I don't think he should have taken the job in the first place. And when he did go, I think we were talking about him being an odd candidate for the job with his lack of top-level club management experience. And you're kind of seeing that the results of that now. I mean, it seemed odd at the time. It's not really panned out very well. And he doesn't really have the managerial credit at club level to buy time, really. Do you know what I mean?
It's always easy to say it's the coach's fault, but should Florentino Perez done a bit more to bring in a big name to replace Ronaldo, do you think?
Well, we were talking about it before we came on air about how they seem to not really commit to either strategy.
Yeah.
To replace him with a massive name.
Yeah.
Or like reset and be like, right, we really develop these new crop of young players over the next couple of years.
Well, I see similarities between Real Madrid and Bayern, actually, where there's a lack of investment in the squad, resting on their laurels to an extent and just expecting success to come rather than investing when you're at the top of your game, like we've seen with City. And we did a podcast recently on the troubles that both of those teams are going through. But I think it's easy to just paper over the cracks and say, oh yeah, well, it's the coach's fault. No, it's not. I mean, what's changed in the last 3 or 4 months at Real Madrid is seismic. Mm. Ronaldo and Zidane are not replaced easily. So, yeah.
I think a big problem as well for Madrid is the lack of gravitas, not just the experience. So you look at Ramos's recent comment. Ramos actually had an appalling game against Barcelona. He had an appalling game. He came out afterwards in relation to Lopetegui and said, look, it's not just about tactics. It's about coaching individuals, managing the dressing room. Effectively admitting, I'm a bit of a handful and I need someone that reins me in, which is kind of, you know, it's kind of what you're saying, really. If you're saying, you're a senior player, you won 4 Champions Leagues, you take responsibility yourself. So I think it was funny that Ramos came out and said that, but it really speaks to the point that Madrid needs a particular type of ego. And you can't arrive at a job like Lopetegui did where Madrid is kind of your finishing school, final destination. Someone like Antonio Conte will walk into that dressing room if he gets the job and will be unafraid of the pressures there. This is also excellent news for Neymar because Real Madrid is in need of a saviour in a way that was not in need of a saviour just four months ago. So if Neymar is to make the transition to Real Madrid at some point, the stage is really set for him, I think. Mm.
See, well, I'm not really convinced that Conte is the guy for that, though. And I might be completely wrong, but it just doesn't seem an amazing fit for me. Because, as I said, because they haven't really committed either way, they have got a lot of really, really difficult personalities in that dressing room and a lot of players who, you know, what Zidane was so good at, whether he's tactically sound or not, you're going to listen to Zinedine Zidane because he's Zinedine Zidane. Mm. He's got a real history with that club. He's achieved at that club. He's won World Cups. He's won European Cups. And he would have been most of that squad's poster on the wall of their bedroom kind of thing. Someone like Conte, I think you saw it at Chelsea that, you know, the season they won the league at Chelsea, they had no European competition. And Hazard said something about how actually boring training sessions were because he had so much time to work with them that he was literally standing them still in positions and being like, when this happens, you need to be here. When this happens, you need to be here. Now, you know,
that's the last thing Real Madrid need.
Exactly.
Right now.
And and then the season after they won the league, when they were combining that with the Champions League, they had a dreadful season. So if Real Madrid had moved on the rest of the aging squad and really committed to a new crop of youngsters, I think Conte would be a really, really good fit. I just don't think they're in either side at the moment. And I mean, it might be amazing. You
unless, never know. Unless Conte is being brought in to provide shock therapy.
Yeah,
in
maybe.
Which case, this is the thing, because if you look at the circumstances in which Conte left Chelsea, frustrated lack of investment, it would seem interesting to me if Conte hadn't said to Perez, look, I know this is the show that you're running, but I'm going to need money. This is my assessment of the squad so far. Obviously, the squad is in decline. Obviously, players are aging. Obviously, people like Ramos are in decline. You know, your best players are not performing their level. Will you back me with funds? And if I happen to fall out with XYZ, will you back me? Because you wonder, like, does this make sense?
Yeah, it's like the Fabio Capello approach. Mm.
Thank you. Is this a proxy war? Because, yes, exactly. Because Real have had a player like a manager like Conte before they had Capello in 97. They brought him from from Serie A. And are they looking to do the same kind of thing, a bit of a reset? You know, they're looking across at Valverde, and Valverde has been delivering at league level. In fact, Barcelona at league level have been delivering. Luis Enrique, Valverde, and Perez is thinking, we also need to be a league side. We need a guy like Conte to run things for 3-4 years. And these players, these senior players in Madrid dressing room, their time is kind of coming to an end. So this is the time to kind of bring in someone who will flush them out.
Well, I'm not going to have the casting vote on whether Conte will be a success at Real Madrid or not, but I do want to mention Barcelona. I was really, really impressed with Arthur.
I'm glad you mentioned him.
He's so good.
Unbelievable.
He's so good. I was just watching him for, I think it was still 1-0. I was just watching how he's so calm, and he's so like, I mean, you're not going to get an Iniesta, but for someone who's just stepped into the team, they've done pretty well there.
Well, the comparisons with Xavi, and I want to just mention this as well. I'm glad you mentioned it. There was a moment when Arthur played, it was in the first, or Arthur, I'm not sure how to pronounce, the moment in the first half where he gets possession and he's pursued by 3 or 4 Real players, and there's a chance to make a counter-attack, but none makes the run for him. And this beautiful moment, he basically weaves left, weaves right, turns, pivots, and plays it back to the centre-back. And I was like, yes.
Yeah.
Because you watch him, and if you contrast his use of the ball with Coutinho's use of the ball, and Coutinho is over-elaborate, wasteful, and you're like, my goodness, Arthur. He's a disciple of Xavi, actually.
He gets the Barca way, doesn't he? You can see it immediately. I can imagine him being in that midfield for years to come. And he looks like he's already been there for years. Right. That's the thing.
Yeah, he's been a great signing.
He looks like he was La Masia trained. It's wild.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Barca midfield, I think Sergio Busquets needs a massive shout because he was brilliant again yesterday. And he's consistently brilliant in Clásicos.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was captain yesterday as well in Messi's absence, which I was a little bit surprised at, actually. I kind of assumed Piqué would get it, but apparently Sergio is next in line. But he was really, really good.
I thought Rafinha was really good as well.
Yeah, Rafinha's come in for the last couple of games. Well, he came in the week for Messi.
Yeah.
And a lot of people expected Dembele to come in. I think it was a brave shout from Valverde, but he's performed in both games. He was brilliant in the Champions League against Inter.
Yeah.
And he was really good yesterday.
Rafinha did a kind of Matuidi. You know, when Matuidi was brought in as a sort of wide forward for France and was fantastic, a sort of defensive wide forward, so he could get forward, but also short down the flanks. Mm. And this is what Rafinha did, the kind of Matuidi role. Mm. And I loved him against Inter. I thought he was terrific in that game. He just gives you so much intensity, technique. He never over-elaborates on the ball, which allows you to bring on your kind of more flamboyant winger, more sort of destructive attacking force like Dembele was in the later period. And also, before I forget, shout out to Rakitic, because Rakitic gets an incredibly hard time from Barcelona Twitter.
I don't understand
why. It's so weird. It's so weird.
His ball over the top for... It was when Suarez hit the post.
The crossfield pass, right.
He's so good.
Delicious.
He's so, so good. And Suarez, I think it was nine goals in 11 Clásicos now for Suarez.
And Sid Lowe actually described Suarez's header as a shot that happened to be with his head.
as that was unravelling, as soon as Sergio Roberto hit that pass, I was like, what a terrible pass. Oh, it's in. Yeah. It was like, it just looked like a completely, like, I was like, why are you giving it him there? Oh, he's somehow managed to direct that in. It was really odd.
This is going to sound quite sort of a weird reference, but the goal it reminded me of was Van Basten's header against Real Madrid in the Champions League semi, or the European Cup semi. I think it was 1990. They beat Real 5-0. Sorry, Real listeners. Another 5-goal drubbing.
Just skip it on a little bit.
Sorry, yeah. It was the 5-0 in the first leg, I think, of the European Cup semi. And Van Basten gets a similar pass where it comes to him at a certain height and he just angles his neck back and puts it in the top corner. And it looks, when you first see the power of it, from a distance, you'd be like, that must have been a bicycle kick.
Yeah, there's something,
the sheer power on the header.
There's something really aesthetically pleasing about headers that are connecting with passes that are still on the rise, kind of.
From a distance.
Or very level. But we're 10 games into the La Liga season now. But Alaves is still second, just a point behind Barca. And Real Madrid are 7 points behind Barca now in ninth. Getafe, Levante, Valladolid, Espanyol, and Alaves are all above Real Madrid.
Wow.
And I think it's probably inevitable he's going to go, right?
Yeah.
It's funny because the Clásico is often a kind of state of the nation in relation to La Liga. And this is a really interesting state of the nation, I think.
But saying that, though, I mean, if you look at the kind of breakdown of the stats, it wasn't really that... It wasn't a drubbing. You know what I mean? It was just... The difference, I think, there was what Barcelona did when they had possession and how they did. Like, Real Madrid had more chances. you know, for example, and, you know, possession was fairly even. I think it was like 52, 53, 47.
It wasn't a drubbing, but it was a cleansing.
Yeah.
It was definitely a cleansing.
Well, there was that in that period when Real Madrid had in this first bit of the second half, and they kind of looked like they didn't know what to do with all their possession, and there wasn't really, they weren't very clinical at all.
One thing I will say, because we'll move on, but there's one moment I was looking at Modric's face at one point when he hit the post with the shot, could have been 2-2. And it reminded me of that 50 Cent song, like, if I can't do it, it can't be done. And I was just like, poor Modric. He's just like, you know, no, really poor Modric. He's like, I have to carry this midfield. Like, the amount of loose passes that came out of other unnamed Toni Kroos midfielders in that game.
People are going to start thinking we've got some kind of sweepstake on what we can drop in as a reference throughout the season. You know what I mean?
Listen, who had
a fiver on 50 Cent? Well done. Well done.
Listen, that, I promise that'll be the last 50 Cent reference I'll make in relation to Real Madrid on this podcast. I suppose we move from the glory of Barcelona to, unfortunately, the tragedy of Leicester. So it took a while for the news to come out to be confirmed, but it's sad to note that the Leicester owner, Wichai Suratnaprabha, has sadly passed away with four other members of the crew. The helicopter crash outside Leicester City Stadium.
Yeah.
Very, very sad.
And some members of the Leicester City board were on the plane as well, we believe.
And his daughter,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. I think five died in total shortly after takeoff.
Yeah, it's obviously hugely shocking news. And, you know, he'll forever be remembered for being the man behind this incredible sporting fairy tale, and the biggest in football, probably the biggest in sport, in my view. Obviously, Ranieri was the coach, but this was the man who not only bankrolled it, but created a great atmosphere at Leicester. You know, and I don't think that anything that they achieved would be possible without the environment that he fostered. So it's a great loss to football.
I will say about Leicester, like, one thing that struck me, I visited just the once, there was a festival I attended there, and what really struck me was, you know, from the moment you get off the train and just start walking around, how diverse it is. And it really is incredible, because the team itself that year, it was a team of diverse talents and nationalities, and there was a real sense of unity and a real community feel about it. And it felt like, you know, it was funny, like, when I went to Leicester, I remember thinking, it's funny because a town that doesn't need a team that's good because it's got so much community already.
Yeah.
And what was incredible, the Leicester team, you know, winning obviously the championship and the Premier League, it seemed to embody that community so much. And I think the reason people are feeling this so much is because, you know, this owner was someone who connected.
Yeah.
Even though he came from outside, he seemed to get the club really fast.
Yeah, and he didn't take money out of the club like we've seen with so many foreign investors, you know.
Yeah, it wasn't done as a just an investment for him.
Right.
It seemed to be something a lot more, you know. I mean, he took them over 8 years ago, got them into the Premier League, managed to keep them in the Premier League that year that it looked like they were absolutely certain to go down.
Yeah.
Invested really smart in, you know, scouting and staff and stuff like that. And then as a neutral, that wave of the year they won the league, seeing it start to unfold and kind of be like, oh, this could actually happen. But it's not going to really happen. It was like everyone was kind of, I think, thinking they're going to fall apart at the end of the season. And it was just, honestly, one of the most incredible things I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And I think that I'm kind of struggling for the words a little bit, because it's just really sad. It's been a really, really horrible week, I think, outside of football as well. There's been a lot of stuff going on continually.
Mm.
We look to football as, it was a really famous quote, I can't remember who said it. It's like, it's not war or death or famine, it's something outside of that. And it's kind of like what we go to escape a lot of the stuff that goes on.
Yeah.
And to see such a horrible tragedy happen within that world so soon after a lot of the stuff that's been going on this week, I think it kind of made it, not that anything like this isn't bad anyway, but it was like a roll on effect, and it's just so sad.
Yeah, it is. I agree with that, and it is really sad, and it's also a really, really sad end to the incredible Leicester story that he started and has now unfortunately, as it has ended in such sad circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously we all want to send thoughts out to anyone who's been affected by it. And obviously, even if you don't know them personally, just being a Leicester fan or being around the club, it's going to hit pretty hard. So I think it's just, yeah, it's just really sad.
Yeah, I just want to echo all of that. I mean, it's such a painful thing because you don't want, you know, you would not wish this on anybody. And for it to happen to the owner of a club and the story, the Leicester story, it just seems such a cruel twist of fate, actually. It seems so, so unfair and so cruel because such a small percentage of helicopters actually crash. And for this to happen to somebody that did so much, not only for Leicester, but for any club that's ever dreamed of breaking into that, you know, oligopoly of like five or six clubs that always seem to win all the major trophies, to have Leicester up there and to put that, it's a cruel, cruel moment. So obviously, yeah, to all Leicester fans listening and all sympathisers, just unbelievable, terrible news, and on behalf of everyone, yeah, condolences all round. Awful.
We should probably say as well, like, you know, happened not long after it was reported that Glenn Hoddle had suffered a heart attack after being on air at BT Sport.
Yeah. Yeah. And he suffered a massive heart attack and only survived by the quick thought of a BT cameraman who knew how to use a defibrillator. And of course, Glenn Hoddle is not only an England legend, but a Spurs legend, and someone who my dad used to tell me all about, his natural talent. And I'm slightly too young to remember him playing, but he's it's very welcome news that he. That he's responding well to treatment and hopefully we'll make a recovery.
Yeah, definitely. Should we take a break?
I think we should on that note.
Back from the break. And before we get into the Bundesliga, I met with Michael Ballack recently, the Germany legend, 98 caps, Bayern Munich hero as well. And he was talking to me about, well, a few things, but the 50+1 rule was an interesting element of the interview, talking about club ownership and how the Bundesliga needs to adapt. But perhaps we can take a quick listen to that now.
Yeah, it's going in the wrong way in Germany, because no one wants a champion who actually knows everyone after the third or fifth a game, you know, and this is something we don't want. It's no competition, and of course,
is it a danger, do you think, for German football that this happens?
Yeah, for the fans, you know, for the attraction and for everything. Yes, for the brand, Bundesliga in general. Because if you know the champion before, it's not helpful. But it's difficult because they're doing a good job, Bayern Munich. They're doing a really good job. So it's a competition, it's an open market, and we have to blame the other teams because of not being good enough, working hard enough, having the right answers, or being competitive enough to challenge Bayern Munich. You know, we can't blame Bayern Munich for being fantastic and doing a good job, but compared to the Premier League, yeah, there's investors coming in. There's some of the clubs, they have this advantage over the last years, and there were less recently, less teams who actually played for the title. Now is five or six teams, they're playing for a title. It's also because money comes in, investors coming in, knowledge comes in, more qualities comes into the league, and that helps the competition. So we should also talk about the 50+1 rule in Germany, which we end up by that. I mean, if we talk about history, what fans like, you know, they love, or tradition, let's call it tradition, because fans love, it starts with the kickoff time. You know, they were complaining or think about changing kick. We changed that. They were complaining, but they accept that now because it makes it more flexible also. It's also, everything has advantage and disadvantage. Then we talk about tradition in terms of stadiums, tradition in terms of how many teams should be in the league. And so Germans are really traditional. They love, and I love it too, but we have to adapt to international competition, and we have our local league, which means the Bundesliga. But if we have a problem in our league themselves, which means there's no competition for the title anymore, maybe we should open us and think about might be changes or bringing more, how we can bring more competition in. And that's, we end up in a 50 plus one rule. I think it's one of the, could be one of the solutions, you know. But yeah, if we carry on like that, we will maybe see the next 5 or 10 years another champion which called Bayern Munich.
I found that like a really great segment and a really well argued case for reform. I mean, before I heard it, I was thinking, nah, like it's Germany, like stick to your guns. Like, you know. But I see his point. In order to create greater competition, you know, in the Bundesliga, that maybe there does need to be some form of a change. Maybe just better regulation of new owners. But
yeah, it's a tricky one. I mean, there's a real balance that is being struck at the moment in Germany, but it's obviously not working. I mean, Ballack has got a point. Bayern are winning the Bundesliga every single year. And we've always said that other teams need to get better and they need to be more professional, just not just on the pitch. They need to be better run in every facet of what they do. But the 50 plus one rule, in my opinion, it served its purpose. And there is a way of regulating German football without it going down the slippery slope towards the Premier League model. And there's a middle ground to be had there, but there's a bit, you know, there's strong arguments on both sides, but I can definitely see that the 50 plus one rule in the not too distant future being no more.
This is a bit of a sore subject for me at the moment because I'm sure people are aware, like Stan Kroenke has just activated the compulsory purchase of the rest of the Arsenal shares to become full owner. Mm. And there was a really good piece actually by Rory Smith on the New York Times website where he contacted a load of Arsenal fans who had had shares in their family for years.
Yeah.
You know, they basically got a letter through the post just being like, you know, you have to sell your shares. It was about more than the money for them. It was about actually feeling that you're part of your football club that you support. And I think that even though it's not it's not exactly the same model as is it with the 50 plus one rule, it's more of a fan consortium that you buy a membership of.
Yeah, exactly.
But still, I think that's a really, really important model that needs to be tweaked maybe as opposed to abandoned. So I wonder if there's like a middle ground where they can achieve more competition or open it up to wider investment, but still maintain that strong fan element. Because in my opinion, that's one of the strongest facets of the Bundesliga. Mm.
Well, speaking of the Bundesliga, let's talk about the action that we saw this weekend. One of the results that stood out to me the most was Leverkusen. I mean, they beat Bremen in their backyard 6-2. It was unbelievable. And the first half, like for all of the amazing attacking play we've seen from Borussia Dortmund this season, I would say that Leverkusen's performance was right up there with that kind of, you know, intensity, high octane, like, you know, just swashbuckling style. And yeah, Julian Brandt, I thought, was great. Bellarabi, interesting stat with Bellarabi. He scored again. And he scored now 3 times in the last 9 days. So his previous 3 goals came across 350 days.
That's crazy.
So it just shows the kind of form he's coming back into finally. And Leverkusen, you know, they're the team that I thought would push Bayern the closest this year. I thought Dortmund was still a work in progress and it would take them another year. Whereas Leverkusen seemed to have all of those pieces coming together more quickly. And they just have endured this terrible start. But yesterday, or Sunday, sorry, was a reminder of what they're capable of.
We've been kind of waiting for them to click, haven't we?
Yeah.
I mean, their front four on paper is so fun. Brandt, Kai Havertz, Kevin Volland.
Leon Bailey.
Leon Bailey hasn't been starting every game, right? I don't think.
Yeah, Leon Bailey has struggled for form.
Yeah, and Bellarabi as well. But Bremen have been in really good form. I mean, they've won 5 out of the last 6.
It's a huge win. To win at Bremen in the form they're in is huge.
Especially in Bremen.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, it was great to see that. Bayern got a win. They're kind of winning ugly at the moment, which is, I think they'll take that in Munich at the moment. It occurred to me that Kovac is kind of similar in some ways to Mourinho in this playing style. In that, well, it's
which era Mourinho?
earlier era, let's say. But it can be very effective, and we saw it with Eintracht Frankfurt. It's not a criticism, by the way. It's a dependence on a really, really strong defense, and turning the ball over quickly. And I just don't think that Kovac has been supported by the Bayern board as much as he deserves to be. If you're going to hire someone like him, you need to support him in the transfer window, and they haven't. But I do think that there is, I do think there's potential for Bayern under Kovac. But it's not going to be the free flowing football that we saw under Jupp Heynckes, for example.
And it wouldn't be Mourinho. It wouldn't be a good Mourinho comparison if there was not a casualty of the club's most flamboyant and exciting player, James Rodriguez. I mean, that's absolutely...
Yeah, well, that's true. And for me, it's crazy that Rodriguez could is being left on the bench. I mean, I think he started two games this year, maybe three. And he was the most important player under Jupp Heynckes last year. He was so good. And we all know his talent. We've seen him before Bayern. And for him to be left out is crazy. But as long as Bayern are winning, and they have only won two games, you know, last couple of games unconvincingly, but James might struggle to get his place back.
I do feel sorry for him because he was on this, it's a 2-year loan, I think it was, and he had a difficult time at Madrid, was left out of the Champions League final by Zidane, and really fought to get back to form and to prominence, and he did it, and he's not done anything wrong. And
absolutely, it's crazy. I feel sorry for him, but yeah, I mean, after the Ajax game, he stormed out 10 minutes after the full time whistle, backpack on, straight in the car. So yeah, he's obviously not happy at the moment.
Like Bayern are up to second now, and it's starting to look a little bit more familiar in the Bundesliga. Only 2 points behind Dortmund, who drew to Hertha.
Yeah, we've got...
Drew with Hertha, sorry.
We've got a huge Klassiker coming up, you know, Borussia Dortmund versus Bayern Munich, and that's on the 10th of November.
I believe we've got someone... Have we got someone going to that?
Yeah, I'll be going to that.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so... In my opinion, the biggest Klassiker for many years. I mean, there was one last season when Dortmund were threatening to be up there, but in the end they tailed off. But Dortmund are actually delivering this year. However, they drew 2-2 with Hertha, and that was not a surprise because Hertha had been good, but Dortmund missed a few opportunities to put that game to bed.
Who scored for Dortmund?
Jadon Sancho.
Oh, there it is. Sancho Corner. Time for this week's show. We should get a jingle for Sancho Corner.
You should make one.
Should we do one?
I just said, no podcast is complete without appreciation.
Can we see when you go to the Klassiker, can you try and get Jadon to record, now it's time for Sancho Corner or something like that?
For you, I'll do it, right?
Thanks, mate. We'll chop it in somehow.
And for me.
Yeah. I mean, I'm Dortmund's form this season, providing they don't get absolutely knackered and their form drops off a cliff, I think that it could come down to the two Klassikers, really.
Well, if you know, you say that's a big if, by the way. Under Lucien Favre, teams have got a history of self-destructing after a season.
Yeah, they usually get one good year, though.
So yeah, they do.
So we're still...
And there's some legs in, you know, Sancho, Pulisic and these young guys up front. Royce looks to be struggling at times.
he's like the oldest one there, right? And he's, what is he, 27, 28?
Yeah. Sancho, by the way, he got two goals, but the other one was kind of a steal off Royce. I don't know if it was going in. I think the ball looked like it was rolled. Maybe was it going wide?
I think it was going wide.
No, I think it was going in, but it was going very slow.
It was going, yeah.
So just
Sancho
thought, get it over with.
Sure, yeah. But yeah, two more goals for him and unbelievable goals, assists. He's exciting. He beats defenders for fun. I felt really sorry for Mittelstadt, the Hertha left back. He just got twisted, turned inside out.
He didn't have fun.
And it will be the same next week this Saturday when Dortmund play Wolfsburg.
Two goals for Solomon Kalou, rolling back the years.
You know, look, head to belly to the blue and white stripes of Brighton and the resilience they showed against Dortmund because it was an onslaught. You know, very Brighton been playing this year, you know, very disciplined, very compact. And Hertha absorbed, you know, with a bit of luck, so much pressure. I mean, Dortmund have blown away most teams.
Well, this is my theory on Hertha, why they get these results against the big teams, because they set up with defence in mind first. Mm. That's why for the last couple of years under Pal Dardai, they've been accused of being boring, and rightly so, because they have been. But now they've added that little bit of flair. They've got guys like Lazaro, Kalou and Ibišević up top who can always score. And against the big teams, they can get results because they know how to set up. Consistency is their problem. So when they play the likes of Freiburg and, you know, no disrespect, but Dusseldorf and Nuremberg, they can't always get those results. And if they could just turn those defeats and draws into victories, there'd be an even higher But I think they're moving in the right direction here to be an interesting team. And by the way, I should just mention that Solomon Kalou's two goals made him the highest scoring Ivorian in Bundesliga history.
Oh, he looked absolutely knackered after that first one. He was so tired he couldn't even get up to celebrate.
Yeah, he was lying face down on the turf.
Just leave me be.
Yeah.
Yep, skipping since I've mentioned Brighton, let's skip across to the home of their origin. Let's go to the Premier League. Yeah. And let's just quickly start with Owen, because I've mentioned maybe on the podcast, but also off it, the fact that Wolverhampton Wanderers, their victims the other day, don't score many goals and Brighton beat them 1-0. And actually are looking like almost the new Watford in the sense of winning close games, really well organised and finishing decisively.
So Brighton are the new Watford and Watford are the new Leicester.
Watford, new Bournemouth.
But weren't,
oh, sorry.
But weren't Wolves
I can't
the new,
get with the programme.
Can't keep up,
but weren't Watford the new Wolves, but Wolves were the new Watford at one point?
I never said that. Watford the Spanish Betis.
What? Hang on.
I think the point is that Brighton are good at home, and Brighton that's three consecutive wins for them in the English top flight. First time they've done that since 1981.
Oh, stat.
Yeah.
That's a great stat.
Yeah, and under Chris Hughton, I mean, it's no surprising that two of those games were at home because they are so resilient at home these days. But Chris Hughton makes teams hard to beat, and Brighton are no pushovers.
They're so established in the Premier League now. They just feel like a fixture. There was a point when Ipswich in the old sort of second division were basically always solid mid-table. Mm. There was a period about 10 years in the sort of late 80s to sort of mid-90s. You could just draw a line across the second division table and you'd find Ipswich there. Yeah. And I think that Brighton have that same sense of permanence about them now in the Premier League. Just the consistency, the kind of...
This is only their second season back though, right? Was the last season the first year they came up?
Right. But they feel, this is what I'm saying, it feels like they're developing something really solid.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
The way that Southampton had before, obviously they're struggling now.
And considering where they've come from,
right.
I mean, it's really not that long ago before, since their sponsors on their shirt were skint, and that's exactly what they were. They had no stadium, no team. The fans were travelling out of town to watch them play. It's pretty amazing what's happened there.
Can I just say one thing I really hope for Brighton is I hope they develop a couple of great young players or bring a couple of players from a different league and then like have some big resale value just to get them, do you know what I mean? Just to get them like a big influx of cash, because it won't necessarily come from, obviously, attendance is not the biggest stadium. I just hope Brighton get in a really great, you know, chunk of investment for a player resale just to solidify their position, because they're such an incredible addition to the Premier League.
Yeah, they are. I agree, and they're kind of a model for teams coming up
on how to
do it. Speaking of teams coming up, I just want to mention Fulham. I mean, they really struggled. You have to say that there's pressure now mounting on the coach. He got them up. Great credit for bringing them through a difficult playoff final, but I think there was a real tactical naivety on the weekend. They were torn apart by a very, very capable Bournemouth team. There's no doubt in that, but they went so attacking. I think he just thought, well, if we just go for it, then we, you know, attack is the best form of defence or something. But in reality, it was just so naive. It was so naive. And they got absolutely hammered. There was no cover at the back. When Bournemouth scored, I can't remember which goal it was, but you had three of their four defenders were their furthest forward on the pitch. They're all over the place. And I fear a bit for Jokanović.
28 goals they've conceded already this season. By far the most in the Premier League.
Yeah. And you know, the stats show if you change your coach, I don't want him to be fired. I think he did a great job getting them up. But the stats show if you fire your coach before Christmas, you double your chances of staying up.
Get Arsenal
and
in there.
I just made that stat up. But
the job that Darren Moore did at West Brom with only a few games to go, you know, almost kept them up. And Fulham are, they're a good squad. They're great players there. The problem, I think, is the underinvestment in the defenders, because they're making errors both individual and collective. So there is a systemic problem there. There's a tactical problem. But the problem is as well that the individual players in defence aren't as good as the ones in midfield. Like, there isn't an equivalent in defence of a Seri. You know, Seri's a fine midfielder, but you need...
Exactly. And you've got guys like Schürrle who have done it at the top level playing in attack. And Mitrovic started the season really well. But defensively, I don't want to name names, but they are poor. Very poor. And that has to be sorted out quickly.
Fulham with new investment and the right manager coming in, and I don't want the guy to be sacked. I'd rather he turned around, but with investment actually crucially in defence and a fresh injection of ideas, whether from the current manager or a new one, they could still turn that around. And also, can I just say, it's a great job for anyone. It's a great job. This is the thing, a Premier League management job puts you on the radar.
Yeah.
And it's a win-win. You manage at Fulham, you play some exciting football, you either get to stay on or you get to look elsewhere.
Should nip across the river, talk about Chelsea.
Absolutely.
Ross Barkley, what a performance.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, I'm so, so happy for him because he endured such a difficult time towards the tail end of his period at Everton, and it was quite horrific, some of the things he had to put up with. And he's decided to make a big move, a brave move down to Chelsea, one that raised a lot of eyebrows when he did it. But Sarri has seen the player which we all saw a few years ago and the potential that he has, and he's fulfilling that now. He is fulfilling that. I mean, it's only a few games that he's done it, but he's shown that if he can stitch together a few starts in the Premier League, he's capable of being an integral part of one of the best teams around.
We've discussed this in relation to maybe writing something more about this in future, but Ross Barkley really is the number eight that we haven't had for a long time, that, you know, Oxlade-Chamberlain could also be. You know, this is the exciting thing, from going from having like no number eights to succeed someone like Lampard, we now have two who play that role, but kind of driving forward, connecting midfield to attack, scoring goals, assisting goals.
Yeah.
Playing in the flow of the game, like a De Bruyne type.
Do you know, physically, he reminds me a bit of Rebic from Croatia.
Oh, that's a good shout.
Yeah, he is very skillful, Ross Barkley, and maybe he doesn't get enough credit for that. But, I mean, his pass for Morata's goal was sumptuous.
For me, his technique is actually the supreme part of his game, and I was always excited about that. And my challenge, I said not my challenge, but I think his challenge was always to bring other parts of his game to that level. And to hear Sarri come out and say that Barkley was now a complete player, that was a real surprise, because that's really fulsome praise. And Sarri's not the kind of person who minces his words. For him to say that after just a few months of working with Barkley was incredibly encouraging, not only for Barkley and for Chelsea, but for England.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really exciting.
And another goal for Loftus-Cheek as well. Four in two games.
Yeah, a reminder to Sarri, perhaps, his quality.
I mean, he was looking like he wasn't going to get a look in, actually, at Chelsea under Sarri early on, and he's starting to play, and I think his performances are warranting more game time, and that would be really good if you can get Barkley and Loftus-Cheek into that side regularly. Good for England as well.
By the way, I'm starting to feel a bit sorry for Giroud. He still hasn't scored, and he just was doing everything to score, and... Mm. But it's not, I mean, with him, it's not always about the goals, but ultimately he is a striker. He would be judged on that. And he was making contributions, but he's becoming like the unluckiest striker in the Premier League.
Well, the good thing is he's enabled so much for Chelsea this season, that they're 2 points off the lead, even in a season where Morata has been streaky, even against Burnley. I mean, he missed a very presentable opportunity as well as scoring a fantastic strike. You know, he scored a great goal, but then missed a very presentable chance. And Giroud has really knitted together that forward line the entire year, which is tremendous. And the great thing about him is, with Giroud, the Chelsea fans love him and the players obviously appreciate what he's doing. Hazard obviously loves him because he's enabled such great form and Sarri is a huge fan. So I think as long as Giroud avoids the comment sections on YouTube, he'll be absolutely fine.
Yeah. Elsewhere, Palace drew 2-2 with Arsenal. Arsenal's winning streak comes to an end. I don't really want to talk about it because Arsenal were dreadful.
How many have you won? 25 straight?
They were dreadful.
They were okay. No. Let's get real. They were very, very poor, Arsenal. Poor. Yeah. And to be honest, they didn't deserve more than the point. It was Mustafi sliding in unnecessarily for a penalty, which I think Socrates is coming back to fitness. I think Mustafi will be the one to lose out. It seems that Emery really likes Rob Holding in the back four.
He's a hothead.
Yeah, I just don't think he's good enough to be a starting centre back if you've got real ambitions on solidifying a top four place. So I think it will be Socrates and Holding will be the two until Koscielny's back in full training now, I think. So he'll be coming back soon.
How long has Koscielny been out for now?
Since the Atletico game in the Europa League last season, ruptured his Achilles.
Wow.
Man United won 2-1. Everything's fine. Did they get to the ground on time? That's what I want to know.
Rumour has it Paul Pogba is still running up for his penalty. I'm very obviously very happy that we defeated Everton. And can I just say, look, for Arsenal listeners, a draw at Crystal Palace has been a good result in the Premier League for the last few years. So let's, you know.
Yeah, I think it's going to be one of those points that I think is going to look quite good for both sides come the end of the season.
Look, any Liverpool supporter listening to this podcast will tell you that a point at Crystal Palace is nothing to be said.
Well, Arsenal lost 3-0 last season, so.
There we go. Yeah. You've made a huge advance. But quickly on United, we won't dwell too long because we often dwell on United on this podcast. But, you know, it's really good to have a win. My one concern is I just worry that Paul Pogba is in danger of slightly undoing a lot of the great work he did over the summer. You know, the slow run up for the penalty and the flicked pass, the flick he did, the unnecessary flick that led to the penalty.
Yeah.
For Everton. This is all needless. You remember that book, the Roald Dahl book, Matilda, where Matilda basically plays around.
Who had Matilda in the sweepstakes? Listen, £10.
When Matilda plays. But the premise of that book, Matilda, is Matilda's this incredibly gifted student who makes all these kind of there's work for idle hands because she's so gifted. She's so much more gifted than everyone else in the class. And she only stops, she cuts out the unnecessary parts of her game when she gets into a class where everyone else is as gifted as her. And Pogba playing for France, where everyone's on the same level, is great because he doesn't mess around. But playing for United, there's almost a sense of being the main attraction. And I,
is it just me though, or did all of that make sense?
Yeah, 100%.
Shout out to Anthony Martial.
Yeah, I wanted to mention him.
Martial, look, football historians will look back, and I think I've said this before, they will look back and they will not believe that a player of that quality did not go to the World Cup.
Yeah.
And that'd be a damning indictment on the way he was coached last year. Yeah. Because it was really poor. Martial is someone you don't actually have to coach that much. You just have to enable a tactical system where he gets in the right position and he'll punish you.
Yeah. That's it. Surely it's not that hard. I mean, that finish for the second goal was first time, just whipped it. It was great. And since he joined United, no United player has scored more goals than him.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And he's been in and out of so many games, you know, dropped to the bench, brought on with 20 to go. I mean, he's been mismanaged.
He did die for the penalty, though.
Yes, he did.
He cascaded.
So the good and the bad.
He cascaded.
Tony Marshall.
He died.
Back from our break, and before we close, let's have a final look around Europe. What's been happening? Ryan?
La Classique happened at the weekend. Marseille, PSG. In Marseille, PSG won 2-0. It was very gritty.
It was, wasn't it? There was bottles and all sorts being thrown onto the field towards the end.
Mbappe came on, scored the first. Lovely goal, actually.
Both goals were great, and Mbappe played a huge role in both. The finish for the first was fantastic. The second one, the ball that he played for Neymar. And Neymar was going for goal and Draxler just picked up the pieces at the far post. But it was all about that pass from Mbappe.
You know, like when counter-attacks happen and you can always see the passes. And if a player doesn't play the pass that you can see is on, you're like, why can't he see that?
Yeah.
That pass from Mbappe, he did me. And I was watching it and could see the whole thing from the... I was like, my eyes went the other way even as the ball went to Neymar.
Yeah, he played a pass that wasn't even on.
I know. And it was so good.
Yeah.
It was really, really good.
I love that people are picking up on that because I was reading the Twitter feed of someone whose work I have great respect for, Kevin Williams, at Kev V. Will. He's a great follow, Barcelona fan, just really knows his stuff. And he was saying how it was interesting that Barcelona had chosen Ousmane Dembele instead of Mbappe because Dembele builds the play better, better associative play, as they say, as the Barca fans say. I think actually, and you know, I agree, I think that's a great assessment from Kevin, but I also think that a part of Mbappe's game that is underappreciated is his ability to make the play, and that's never better revealed than when you're running a counter-attack, because when you're running a counter-attack, you've got two people running off you. There was a great example of that recently, actually, Mohamed Salah leading the counter, and I think that what makes Liverpool so special, they've got three players equally good at leading the counter, Firmino, Mane and Salah, but I think with PSG now, you've got Neymar that can lead the counter and Mbappe too. Well, so that's a huge asset.
It's the best forward line in Europe. They're not the best team in Europe, but those three.
That's a big shout, actually. You know, I'm
sorry, I'm a
now.
Bit shook.
We haven't had a hot take like that for a while, actually.
Not since, what was it, Joe Gomez's new Varane.
He's on better form than Varane.
Yeah, he
that's
is.
His
yeah.
Fair, that's fair
yeah,
assessment.
Yeah, I don't look so stupid anymore.
We have the greatest respect for your opinions.
Let's dart to Naples. Napoli 1, Roma 1.
On paper, you'd think that was a better point for Roma than Napoli, but overall, I don't know.
Yeah, I think Napoli were the better side. They had a lot more chances. Insigne had a few chances. Insigne is in amazing form at the moment.
There's a great piece on Insigne by James Horncastle, who was on last week's podcast on Insigne. It's on ESPN's website. You should read that.
Yeah, I mean, he's incredible. Dries Mertens came on, had two goals, disallowed for offside, and then equalised in the 89th minute. And not a bad point for Napoli. I mean, Roma haven't been, they've been kind of stuttering a little bit, but I think, yeah, important to get away with a point there. Before we run, Zlatan's playoff dreams are over. LA Galaxy needed to win yesterday against Houston Dynamo and were 2-0 up and lost 3-2.
Well, I'd like to say about Zlatan, I mean, Zach Goldman, who is someone who's a great follower on Twitter, I think his Twitter handle is Zachy Goldman, actually, if you check him out. Zachy, Z-A-C-K-Y Goldman.
Yeah.
He said, look, even though the Galaxy had a terrible season, Zlatan had probably the greatest individual season in the history of the MLS. If you look at, you know, goals and assists per 90 minutes.
Well, this is the thing. The fact that they were even in a shout for a playoff place is staggering, considering right. where they were when he took over, when he came in, sorry. Well, kind of
when he took over. Zlatan, he took over, yeah.
Player manager. But yeah, I think, you know, next season, I think now that he'll be there, because he joined after the start of the season. So I think full season with them next season, they should be fine.
Can I say as well to Zlatan, like, there is somebody that restores prestige. He did it for United and he did it for LA Galaxy, and he is someone that has legacy in that sense. He does give you a shot in the arm when you need it most as a club. All good. Well, that is a bumper edition. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for listening to Mr. Ballack's words. Please provide your comments. The rest of that Q&A will actually be available on the Rabona site, I believe.
Yeah, that's correct. The Q&A will be on the Rabona Mag website, rabonamag.com.
A little bit of housekeeping before we go. If you like the podcast, we're kind of, you know, we don't have a massive promo campaign at the moment. So tell people, recommend it. And also, if you listen to on iTunes, it would be great if you could drop a review and a rating. It really helps to build stuff.
Always welcome. Thank you so much for joining me again. Listeners, Michael, Ryan, always a joy. Find us on social media and all other platforms at Rabona Mag. And we'll catch you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics, all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.